Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Data, analytics, big data science, machine learning, customer insight, behavioral science, blockchain, data ops, data engineering, agile working. Phew, too many terms, too many things to think about. Do you as a leader need somewhere to turn? To hear what other leaders are doing? To hear what really makes a difference in your business? Welcome. The Customer Insight Leader Podcast is here for you. Each episode, we'll be interviewing a different leader in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics to hear what they really do, what really makes a difference. So settle down, get that cup of coffee, and enjoy the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast, a place to hear from today's leaders in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics. I'm your host, Paul Loughlin, and with me today is Alison Williams. Alison is the global head of data at the world-famous agency dunnhumby. Unlike many data leaders who change organizations regularly, Alison, a bit like me actually, has spent most of her career at one place, at dunnhumby, where she says she started out on their graduate program and learned about data on the job. These days, as global head of data, Alison manages a number of data and deployment disciplines across that organization. So it sounds like we're going to have plenty to discuss as we explore on this podcast her career and what she's learned along the way. Welcome, Alison.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here as well. Thank you for being a guest, Alison. I'm delighted to have you on the show for a few reasons. Firstly, you've helped to address a prolonged spell of solely male and actually solely white leaders as well. So thank you for helping a little bit with my diversity on this podcast.
I'm very happy to help with that angle.
Great. Actually, also, given how well-known dunnhumby are, it's maybe been too long that I've had a leader on here from dunnhumby. So thank you for saying yes to my invitation. I think with all the guests that I've had on this podcast, we start off by asking them to share their backstory, their career history, so that listeners know where you're coming from and can begin to paint a picture of the career that you've had. So, Alison, could you tell us a bit about your background and why you've built your career at dunnhumby?
Yeah, so I always like to start this story by going right back to my academic career, mm-hmm. Because it does tend to be a bit of a different path from most people in the kind of data and data science industry. So my degree was actually in history. I didn't do anything to do with stats or maths or computing or data science. I was very much an arts graduate. I studied history. I focused on economic history and Cold War history. And I really chose that subject because I was interested in it and I thought I need something that I'm personally kind of motivated by to get me through the 3 years and hopefully come out with a good degree. So I did that not really knowing what I was going to do after uni. And even when I graduated, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I ended up doing some traveling, and I actually taught English abroad. I went to Peru for a while and taught English there.
Oh, nice.
And amazing experience, challenging in lots of ways, but really a really great experience. And then when I came back about a year later, I started to apply for graduate programs. Again, it's kind of embarrassing to say, but again, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was more focused on finding a good company that could really see my potential and kind of give me the opportunity to learn a discipline and to learn an industry.
Yeah.
So that was what led me to discovering dunnhumby. Mm-hmm. It was a much smaller organization then. It was about 250 people, so probably about a tenth of the size it is now.
Wow.
And predominantly the work we did in the UK was with Tesco.
Yes.
Which, you know, we still work with now, but we were much smaller. I think at that point we did have a presence in the US, but really, you know, the majority of the work and clients were in the UK.
Yeah.
So I applied for their graduate program and got accepted, and essentially had a kind of crash course in coding and data engineering. We used SAS back then. We did kind of base SAS, so we didn't even have nice UIs to help us along. It was proper
Good old
hardcore
SAS coding.
coding. Yeah, exactly. Which I'm hugely grateful for because it really gave me such a solid foundation in understanding, ETL and data transformations and really the complexities of working with customer and retail data. So I got a huge amount of training and support. I was surrounded by incredibly smart people that were really willing to help. And so I developed in that role as a data engineer. I was loading up our data solutions, doing programming. I was lucky enough to be on a graduate program, so I did some sabbaticals in other teams as well. So I did some
Nice.
media targeting and some software engineering. And then after a couple of years, I felt like I'd kind of got a good foundation, a good start in the data world, and I decided to pursue another angle that I was had always really been interested in, which was going into the public or charity sector.
Oh, okay.
So I joined a big charity. It's the RNIB, Royal National Institute for Blind and Partially Sighted People, and I worked there for about a year and a half in their fundraising department. And I was, it was kind of the equivalent of what I was doing at dunnhumby, in that rather than looking at how we could personalize the experience of shoppers in retail, it was looking at how we could really personalize the experience of donors for the charity to help increase fundraising. There were lots of parallels. So there was definitely kind of elements of my dunnhumby career that I could lend to that sector and some expertise that I could bring. But I felt that after about a year and a half, I'd kind of run out of that, and I was still very early on in my career and wanted to learn more and wanted to have people around me that I could really gain experience from and gain opportunities from. And actually, I realized that it was too early on in my career to make that move, and that I could bring more value to that sector by kind of using the private sector to learn more and get more experience. So that was quite a pivotal moment really for me, and deciding kind of what direction my career was going to go in, and really what was important to me, the difference between wanting to do something for kind of a greater purpose, but actually day to day having to have that opportunity to learn and gain more experience. So I decided to go back into private sector, and thankfully dunnhumby had just landed a new big contract with Tesco to work with all their international markets. So we were suddenly expanding from the UK to, I think it was, 11 new markets across the globe. Yeah, which was quite something. So taking, some of our flagship software products that we'd built over time and had developed quite organically, and suddenly having to kind of productionize the deployment of them and roll them out at scale across different countries. So there was suddenly a lot of opportunities back at dunnhumby, and I'd made a lot of good friends there and was in touch with a lot of people. So I was asked to come back and do a deployment kind of technical project management role to help roll out all those software products across those different international markets. So I came back and did that, and that was an amazing experience. Lots of new challenges. As I said, we were taking things we'd built very organically and trying to turn them into something that we could roll out repetitively, very quickly, very efficiently. And lots of challenges of working in new countries, new languages to deal with, new kind of ethical considerations around some of the customer data that we were receiving, and local legislation considerations. So it was a really exciting time, and went really well. And then yeah, which is good. It's hard work, but really good fun. And then through that role, I recognized that one of my key strengths was the ability to really sit between the kind of the business world and the data and technical world, and become almost a translator between those two, we had a bunch of kind of commercial considerations and commercial requirements that needed to be translated into technical and data requirements. And actually, I was able to do that quite well and kind of speak both languages.
That'd be so valuable.
So that really set me off in a direction of the roles I've been in for the last probably 10 years, which has been kind of client-facing data roles and really working with clients to define what do we need from them in terms of data and technical requirements to then be able to provide the products and services that we've sold them from Dunnhumby. So I did this, I've done this over the years, and I've been lucky enough to move around the business quite a lot and focus on different areas. So sometimes there's been a geographical focus. So I worked on all of our Asia clients for a while. We were getting started in China, which was, again, lots of new considerations around working with companies that are, you know, partly owned by the government. And what does that mean? I also worked within our media business for a while. So understanding the new world of programmatic targeting was new to me at the time. I worked quite extensively over the Tesco business, which has been a huge learning for me, really invaluable work, because Tesco are just so progressive in the work that they do around building customers into their plans and decisions and really focusing on the customer experience through data. So they, you know, they really push and challenge us to help them with that. So that's been amazing experience. And then the most recently, in the last few years, I got the opportunity to relocate to Chicago and run our North America data team, which was great. Yeah, I had a wonderful 2 years in Chicago. Just fascinating to be really submerged in a new culture and really understand the business there from the ground up. And then more recently, so this is turning into a very long story, sorry.
It's an interesting and fascinating career, Alison. It's not a problem.
Yeah, you think it could be boring being in one company, but it definitely hasn't been boring. At the end, towards the end of my time in Chicago, I took a new role, which was really defining and setting up our data consulting business. So for a long time, we had really focused on gaining access to clients' data so that we could plug it into our products and solutions and make it available to our data analysts and data scientists. And through that work, we've built up a huge amount of expertise and knowledge on customer data and how to make it accessible. And what we realized is that our clients could be hugely benefiting from this within their own business, not just with the work with Dunnhumby. So we set up a small team of consultants that work directly with clients to help them with their data strategy. So that was something I felt really passionate about and really feel this huge amount of value for our clients. So I was delighted to be asked to set that up. And then I took a year off for maternity leave. So I had my son Adam in July 2018. And I took a year off. Thank you. So I had 6 months maternity leave in Chicago, 6 months in the UK. And then when I came back to work, at that point, I was promoted into my current role, Global Head of Data. So I'm now leading a team of about 145 people across the globe. We've got a big hub in Gurgaon, just outside of Delhi, where we've got the majority of our data engineering team. We've also got teams in the UK, US, and amongst some of our client sites as well. So we've got technical account managers working directly with clients, a deployment function which focus on kind of project management of our deployments, and a small data propositions area, which is looking at kind of what are the future data products and services we want to provide.
Great. Gosh, what a career, Alison. Thank you for sharing that. It's really brought it to life. So that was good. Wow, there's several things I want to follow up on there. You've given me all sorts of trains of thought. Before I forget them, let me just touch on a couple of things that struck me as you were sharing that. So first off, I think I said in the introduction, unlike a lot of data leaders who move around a lot and almost see it as, oh, coming up to 3 years somewhere, must be time to move, you, more like my own experience, have seen benefit staying in one organization. Apart from how many different things you've done, as you've kind of shared with us. Why do you think that's been a good choice? Do you regret not having moved around? Why do you value having stayed in one place?
I think for me, I've had every opportunity at Dunnhumby I've kind of ever wanted. So right. At every point in my career where I've felt, you know, a bit of an itch, and you know, maybe I've done a role for a while and I feel like I've kind of learned a lot, but I'm ready for the next challenge. Mm. I've been lucky enough that there's always been a new opportunity within Dunnhumby. And there's so many elements about working there that I've really loved and benefited from. As I said at the beginning, I've been surrounded throughout my career by really smart people that want to help me learn. But the culture is a really big factor for why I've stayed at Dunnhumby, and I think why a lot of people do stay there for a long time. Mm. And then also just the growth, both in terms of kind of new clients, new countries, but also, you know, trying to develop new propositions, new areas of the business, being able to do things like set up the data consulting practice. You know, there's always been the opportunity to grow the business and look at new ways of doing things. So I think that there's never been a point where I've got bored or not felt that there's been an opportunity to learn or grow or do something different. And the benefits of being in Dunnhumby for so long is that I've got a really good, deep understanding of the business. I've got a great network across the business.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got a great network of Dunnhumby alumni as well, which is, we're everywhere.
Yeah.
It's really only ever been a positive for me. So it's never been a hardship to kind of make that decision to stay.
Brilliant. That is so good to hear. That several things resonate with me, but that's great to hear, Alison. I guess another thing that really struck me as very positive in your story, and perhaps unusual, is hearing about you coming back from maternity and getting promoted. You know, and I know from a lot of very talented women in the data and analytics industry, there can be a fear associated with being off on maternity, of either roles ultimately being at risk or certainly them being set back in their career from that time.
Yeah.
Is that just the positive Dunnhumby culture? Is there anything else you would share as to why you think that has been such a positive experience for you, which is what it sounded like?
Yeah, it was very positive for me. It's definitely a real issue across, I would think, most companies in the industry, and Dunnhumby definitely has got, you know, some periods and some history that where it was much harder to progress if you were going to take a break from work for whatever reason. But certainly within the organisation, there's been a really big push over the last few years to really recognise the value of a diverse workforce, which means recognising that people don't necessarily follow the same path through their career, and some people will take breaks for, you know, childcare, maternity, or whatever else it might be. So I think the culture within the business has changed, but also I mean personally, this is something I feel really strongly about, diversity, inclusion, equality, and it's something I've been very conscious of for at least the last kind of 5 or 6 years, about how that plays out in the workforce and within Dunnhumby with things like maternity leave. So I think there were probably two elements. It was already something I was very conscious of, so I very proactively talk to my manager about you know, plans to start a family, and I was very open with him about that. Which I think and he was incredibly supportive, and to give you an idea of the culture that I had, certainly with my manager and within the team, when I relocated to Chicago, my husband and I had been trying to start a family for quite a while. We'd had a lot of problems. We actually had our first son was stillborn about 7 years ago. Thank you. So my manager knew we were, you know, actively trying to start a family, and And I assumed that that would mean something like a foreign relocation would just be off the cards. Why would a company invest in moving you around the world if you're just going to run off on maternity leave? And I realized that thankfully my manager and many people across the business were much more progressive than that, and realized that, a year off maternity does not need to impact the long term value and benefit that you can bring to a company. And hopefully they've seen that I took a year off, but I've been back 2 years now, and I certainly plan on having many years ahead of me where I'm hopefully really adding value to the business. So thankfully I think the culture is really changing, and knowing that I was trying to start a family has never stopped my progression or never stopped any opportunities. And the kind of the ultimate illustration of that was the fact that when I came back from maternity leave, I was then offered a promotion,
Yes.
which I was, yeah, really, really delighted by.
That is really good to hear. Thank you for sharing that and being so open with us, Alison. I think
Thank
that'll
you.
be an encouragement to a number of leaders and analysts. Another thing that struck me, and you very much highlighted this when you were telling your career story, is that history degree. Unusual in data careers. Surprisingly, I've also had the experience of hiring people who were history graduates and found them to go on to be very excellent analysts in their analytical thinking and their dealing with uncertainty and needing to make assumptions, etc. So I'm not as surprised as some might be, but it is unusual for data leaders, definitely. I wonder whether you think that the focus that I've certainly seen in recent years, which is graduates are encouraged to go and or go and do a degree in data science or get a specific degree in data engineering so you can go on to the data engineering role. Do you think those who are hiring now are missing a trick? Are they thinking too narrowly now about it must be a graduate with data on the label?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm biased from my background, but yes, I do think they're missing a trick. I mean, as I said, like, diversity and inclusion is a really important topic for me. I think there is so much evidence to show that a diverse set of experiences and opinions really contribute to a much more successful, productive team and outcome. And I think that as hiring managers, our role is to really look for as many proxies to help us identify diverse experiences as possible. And the sort of traditional things that people look at are things like gender and ethnicity and maybe socioeconomic background. But I think education is definitely one of those. When I look around me, a lot of my peers do have much more kind of scientific, mathematical backgrounds. And I do feel different from them. I do feel like I think about things differently. I approach things differently. I maybe pick up on some things that they don't, and vice versa. There's certainly things that I miss that they are straight on top of. And I think that what that brings is just a better holistic outcome, in that you start to bring together lots of different ideas and opinions and approaches, and you can really start to critique each other's views and assumptions and get to that better outcome. So yeah, I definitely think that education should be one of those things that we are thinking about. How can we bring more diversity into that? And the type of education you get from a say, like, history, geography, maybe kind of social sciences, it really teaches you about learning and critiquing and understanding and weighing up different sides of an argument. And all of those soft skills, are they're hard to learn on the job. You can do a coding course, plenty of options for that, but I think some of those softer kind of skills and the aptitude for learning is much harder to do a course on. So actually, there's real benefit to bringing people in that have got that broader education.
Completely agree. I mean, as someone who trains in softer skills, I'm going to be cheering you to the rafters there. But no, completely agree, Alison. Funnily enough, when I was hearing you on that, it reminds me of Matthew Syed's book, Rebel Ideas, the importance of cognitive diversity, not just appearance of diversity, but actually the people with different ethnicity or gender all happen to think the same. You need cognitive diversity as well. So it's a good point.
Absolutely.
I also noticed you sang the praises of the time you spent in that data engineering role working on extract, transformation, and load ETL and data pipelines, etc. And that was a great foundation for your later roles. I wonder, people who aspire to go on to successful data leadership careers like yourself, do you think it's beneficial to try and deliberately have a foundation of having done a number of the different data roles so you really understand how the pieces fit together?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I think this is honestly, this was, I did this graduate program 16 years ago, and I still credit this with having a, an impact on the way I do my job today.
Wow.
Being able to really truly empathize with the team that you're working with. So you know your job, you know what the people around you are doing, but being able to understand what the other team that you're delivering to are doing, or the team that are providing you with requirements, to be able to put yourself in their shoes, understand what are their objectives, what's their agenda, how do they work, what are the stresses that are in their world, what are the things that are you know, putting pressure on them, and how can I work in a way that helps them? I don't think there's any substitute for building that empathy than actually, you know, walking in their shoes and doing that job. And I think the again, kind of talking about soft skills, the use of empathy in business and in the, you know, in the data and tech and science industries, really it's such a valuable kind of mindset.
Yeah.
And I think that it can almost get you out of, you know, any problem. It can almost get you out of anything if you can really tune into the people you're working with or your client. And yeah, so I think being able to do a stint in a, you know, in a data science team, data engineering, software development team, and ideally even commercial team. So if you're in the commercial sector, if you can, you know, work in the sales team for a while and understand the pressure they're under and why they're asking you the questions they're asking you, next time you can anticipate that because you understand exactly what they're going into and what they're facing with their clients. So yes, I would really encourage people to proactively seek out that opportunity. Interestingly, actually, I had a conversation with a colleague yesterday who's the same grade as me now in Dunhumbie, and we were talking about potentially doing some shadowing across our roles, and we were both talking about the value that we've had in doing this previously and at the beginning of our careers, and actually we can see huge value in being able to do it now, you know, 15, 16, 17 years into our careers, we still think there'd be huge value in it.
Great example, Alison. I loved hearing you put together the technical aspects and empathy. I think it's a beautiful example of the alchemy of successful analytics, that a deeper technical understanding can actually empower that softer skill of empathy. It's beautifully put. I was also struck, and I think a number of people this might ring a chord with, given the conversations I've had with analysts, of the time when you went and worked with RNIB, you had the desire to work in a charity, to give back in that sense, and yet ultimately came back to Dunhumbie because you also wanted to be developing your technical skills and improving and growing so that you could do and give more. I think there might be a number of people at different stages of their careers, possibly out there, who feel this tension. They have a desire to give back and maybe do roles, but recognize quite often going and working in a charity means taking a technical step back and not developing their capabilities. Any thoughts as to how they can strike that balance, overcome that frustration, scratch that itch, however you put it?
Yeah, absolutely. So, What I really thought about was what did I want out of my day-to-day job, and what did I want out of working in the charity sector? And I realized with the charity sector, the desire I wanted to fulfill was to be able to give something back, use my time and my education and my skill set to be able to contribute to something good and something that I felt really personally was really important. And then day to day, I really wanted to be able to learn and grow and get lots of responsibility and lots of opportunity. And those two things, just at that point in my career, I they just didn't kind of fit in one job in one organization.
Yeah.
And so I really thought about, okay, well, how can I fulfill these two things? So I decided that work-wise, that would be the, you know, my day-to-day job at Dunnhumby would be the bit that helped me with my career development and my progression. And that actually I could fulfill that desire to work with a charity through volunteering.
Hmm.
So I became a Childline counsellor. So I trained up with Childline. So they're a listening service for children and young people in the UK. And I had amazing training with them, which although it was specifically focused on how to provide a listening and counselling service to children, it gave me a huge insight just into how to work with people, how to be you know, child centric or customer centric or people centric, how to listen to people, you know, really listen and understand and not jump to solutions and kind of try and solve everything. So I did some great training with them, and then I worked every Saturday as a counsellor, talking to young people. And it was easily one of the hardest things I've ever done. You can imagine some of the challenging situations that children are in, and trying and having to listen to that and you know, have the patience to let them talk and not try and kind of, you know, jump in and get them out of really dire situations, but actually give them the space to work through their problems and come up with their own solutions. A really big part of Childline's philosophy is about empowerment and helping children to be empowered to find the right solutions for themselves and to take control of their lives, really. And so so it was incredibly hard, incredibly rewarding, and I learned so much. And it really helped me to fulfill that need to or that desire to you know, to contribute my time and my effort to something that I really believed in. And thinking about it now, if I had used my you know, my day job skills, I could have gone in and worked for the same charity and done some work in fundraising or, you know, some data analytics for them. But actually, on a personal level, I really enjoyed those conversations with the children and the young people. Some of them were just amazing and so inspiring. And so it actually gave me a whole new kind of way to communicate with people and a new thing in my life, all this training. So it turned out to be the best move I could have made, and you know, work wise and sort of personally, it was the perfect combination.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that, Alison. What a great answer, and hopefully inspires other people toward that possible outlet. Certainly sounds here. I hear the benefits you've derived from it. The other thing I noticed, or one more thing I noticed in this rich career story, we've had plenty of room to explore, was your mention of the translator role, that sort of account management role. Funnily enough, it reminded me a few years ago, an earlier guest on this podcast is Martin Squires, who's now at Pets at Home Group. And we exchanged some blog posts on my blog on the topic of this role and whether business partners, account managers, translators as a separate role were a good thing or a bad thing. I was arguing for and Martin was arguing against. They seem to be the Marmite of data roles, don't they? People don't tend to be neutral on these. Whether they should be a separate role, people tend to strongly agree with or strongly disagree with. So are you a fan? Tell me what you view of translator roles as a role.
Yeah, I mean, my experience of working with customer data is it can become incredibly complex, and there are a huge amount of kind of nuances in data and tech, and so I think these roles in certain organizations and depending on what the organization, what kind of service or product they're providing, they can really be vital. And Dunnhumby is definitely an area where I think they truly are vital. I mean, it's essentially the role is, it comes back to that word again, empathy. The role is really about embedding themselves in the client or understanding really what is the client trying to get to, and being able to convert that into technical requirements. And I think that unless it's an incredibly simple product or piece of software, then you do need that translator role. I've got an example that's come up this week actually at work. We've had an RFP from a client, and they're potentially interested in some of our products and services, but they've got a very specific requirement, which is that they want everything hosted within their single tenant cloud solution, and which is quite a specific requirement that we don't often come across, hardly ever, in fact. And you could take that on face value, but actually what we want to do and what this translator role and this technical account management role really can do in this scenario is work with the client to understand what is behind that requirement. It could be that it's about data privacy and that they are unwilling to have any customer data leave their area. But it could be that it's down to a contract negotiation with the cloud provider, and they've, you know, they've negotiated a great rate, but they've got a minimum spend and they need to make sure that they hit that, so they want everything running on their system. Or it could be that they want to minimize the effort for their IT team. They've, you know, they've just scaled back their IT team. They don't want the IT team distracted with sending data out to other organizations. So there's a whole bunch of things that could be behind that. Sure. And so we need to understand that to be able to come up with the right solution for that client. And then even then, if, you know, if it turns out, yep, that's the right thing, we need to get into the details of it. You know, what does that mean for their responsibility for infrastructure, for disaster recovery? There's a whole host of questions that throws up. And without having that role that can really sit between the client and get into detail with the client and understand exactly what are they trying to do and what they're trying to achieve, and then work with the internal teams to say, okay, how do we meet those requirements? Then we just end up with assumptions and missed expectations. So yeah. I definitely feel like it's a vital role, especially at the beginning of that relationship, and then even ongoing. If you're working with a client that's you've got a big engagement with them, you know, you're selling them lots of products or services, or you've got a lot of work with them, you need that ongoing relationship. You need to understand what their technical roadmap is. You know, how are things changing on their side? Almost all of our clients at the moment are on some kind of transformation program where they're moving to the cloud, they're building their own data science capabilities. So we want to understand what their roadmap looks like so we can support it and enable it and be in sync with it, make it efficient. And having that technical account management role to really manage and own that relationship and understand that and plan that is really vital to the relationship ongoing.
Nicely argued, Alison. I agree with you. And it was good to hear how much you brought out the technical understanding as well as the empathic understanding and commerciality that are all there in sometimes an undervalued skill set, the translators.
Yeah.
I was also struck, and I will try and come to a close at some point of exploring this rich vein of your career history, by you mentioning obviously the time in Chicago, and brilliant that you ended up giving birth there and having some maternity leave there, but the time earlier as well when Tesco was expanding all over the world. You've clearly had the experience of working internationally. Perhaps thinking particularly about your time in Chicago, do you find You learned much from that? Were US analysts very different to managing people in the UK? Was there a growth in your leadership career through leading people out in the US, not just the UK?
Yes, yeah, definitely. There were, I think the first thing that struck me when I moved out there was the culture was quite different, which I hadn't really anticipated. You kind of think, you know, the language is the same, food's broadly the same, you know we watch so much American TV, you kind of think you know what you're going into. But what I picked up on fairly quickly was the openness and the focus on really positive kind of open language about praising people and recognizing people and talking about people's achievements. And I guess it, the difference from the UK is we tend to be a bit kind of shy and a bit awkward sometimes about being, so the word I used to use was gushy, you know, if you've been a bit gushy about someone, like overly praising them. Mm. And my first experience of this was one of the managers in Dunnhumby at the time in North America. She was the office manager for our Cincinnati office, and she had a list of everybody's start date. And every time their anniversary came round, she would send out a note to them, that a personal email that basically said, thank you so much for everything you've done. And she'd list some of the things that they'd done in the past year and maybe older than that. And I was really surprised at how emotional her language was. Mm. And then I realized, actually, this wasn't that uncommon. And it went down really well, and people really appreciated it. And so, you know, I realized if I was going to be successful at managing a team there, I had to recognize that there was an element of expecting that kind of language and that kind of recognition, which I do think was different from managing a team elsewhere. So I tried to kind of adapt my behavior and style, which, to be honest, wasn't too difficult because I'm quite a people-centric manager anyway, and I really enjoy the sort of the people leadership and people development. So it wasn't a huge push for me, and it probably actually just freed all the things I wanted to say all the time, and just felt a bit kind of constrained in the UK.
Exactly.
Nice. I embraced it.
Excellent. Okay. Alison, one of the things I try and always do on each podcast episode is also protect some time for those of our listeners who are a bit earlier in their career. From what I can tell, it's a mixed audience who listen to this podcast. Some are a little bit older and more senior in their careers. Some are much younger and probably more junior in their careers. So for those who are more starting out, if I use that term, I wonder, looking back with the benefit of hindsight now, how would you advise that they develop? What skills and knowledge do you think they should be focusing on developing now earlier in their career?
Yeah, that's a good question. With the benefit of hindsight, the advice I would give is actually something I don't think I have done very well, which is why I would recommend doing which is really thinking about how to make your personal development part of your standard routine. So how do you make sure that you have time aside for your personal development? So building it into your, you know, your weekly schedule or your monthly schedule or your, you know, your quarterly goals, however you plan your time, I would really recommend thinking about how do you just make it a standard part of it. And so you no longer have to kind of battle to put time aside for training, for educating, and really just make it kind of part of the way that you do your job. And I think if you can do that at the beginning and, you know, make that an embedded part of the way that you, you work, it's going to really help you long term. And I think part of that is also working out what are the ways that suit you to develop yourself. Like, are you someone that likes to read? Do you like podcasts? Do you like formal training, online training, in classroom training, if available? And really think about kind of what suits you in your learning style, and then how do you make that just a unquestionable part of the way you do your job?
Sorry, Alison, go on.
No, I was just gonna say I don't think I've done that well enough. I struggle to put time aside for personal development, and I would love to do more of it. I love learning. I love kind of going back to academic ways of learning. So I always feel frustrated that I can't do more of that. And I think if I'd been more choiceful about it in the early days and just made it an embedded part of the way I work, I think it would have really helped me.
Yeah, that makes good sense to me, Alison. Good tip. I know even from my own experience, even at my advanced years in more recent time, protecting certain times of the day when I will read. It's surprising. You don't need a huge amount of time, but if every day that time is definitely protected in your reading, it's astonishing how much reading you get done. It really is.
Absolutely. And I think it's getting to the point where you don't question it.
Yes.
You don't say, can I put this time aside or not? It's just there and that's it.
Yeah, completely agree. Good tip there. Hope that helps you listeners. Okay, last question, Alison. This has been a delight. Thank you. Thank you so much. Can you give me an example of something you've changed your mind on in the last few years, just to show that even as developed leaders as you aren't finished products, we're still growing and being willing to change our mind? What have you changed your mind on in the last few years?
Oh, yeah, I have a long list to choose from. I'm definitely still in the development mode. So we talked a bit about diversity and inclusion, and you mentioned at the beginning that I'm one of the few women on your podcast. I mean, my career in data has, I have definitely been in the minority in almost every meeting and every meeting room I've ever been in as a woman in the data industry. And when I set out in my career, my kind of go-to strategy was, you know, look to the people around me that are successful and try and emulate them. And that, you know, that by and large was men. Mm. So at lots of points where I had a decision to make about a role to take or a conversation to have or a challenge to make, I would think, okay, you know, what would a man do in this scenario? Mm. And try and sort of channel that. And what I realized in the last few years is that really that is just that approach is just keeping the bias going. It's really just supporting the kind of inherently unequal structures that we've already got in place. Mm-hmm. And actually what I've really started to think about is, well, why is that particular tactic successful? It's because the framework or the structure has been set up, that, you know, the situation is set up to accommodate a man's perspective or a man's mm-hmm. approach. Mm-hmm. And actually that's what we should be questioning, and it shouldn't be that people have to, and you know, I'm talking about gender, but it comes to all different types of diversity. It shouldn't be that people have to pretend to be somebody that they're not to be successful, and mm-hmm. what it ends up is people are put in situations that they're not comfortable in, and forced to behave a way that they don't feel comfortable with and isn't true to themselves. And I think a really classic example is the kind of pay rise and pay equality that, you know, yes. There's a whole load of research that says that, you know, men are generally paid more for lots of reasons, but one of them is that they're more likely to ask for a pay rise, or they're more likely to ask for more when they do get a pay rise than women.
Yeah.
And so the you know, certainly my old view and lots of people's view is the answer to that problem is women need to be more forthcoming and need to ask for more and need to be more like a man and, you know, and push for a higher pay rise. Mm. Actually, let's question, why is the system set up that, you know, it takes that? Why can't we recognize that women maybe are expecting to be given a pay rise based on merit and based on work? You know, let's take the emphasis and, to be honest, the burden off of women changing their behavior and start thinking about how do we make the whole kind of structure more equal and more open to different approaches. And so that's something I really changed my mind on. And I know part of that is educating myself and thinking about, you know, the kind of the broader or the more underlying problems. But also I do recognize that some of it is an element of the position of privilege that I'm in now. I'm in a senior role. Mm-hmm. I know that when I challenge and I talk about things like this, that, you know, people will listen and will I have, you know, I'm confident that I can have some element of influence. And so I know that's much, much harder when you're starting out in your career. Not only have I changed my mind on it, but I've also recognized that I've got a responsibility to be kind of the voice of that other argument and to talk about that on behalf of people that aren't quite there in their careers where they do feel like they can challenge, you know, some of those much bigger sort of systemic problems.
That's great. That's great. That makes good sense, Alison, and a really nice way to end our conversation, actually. I think it draws together a number of themes of what you've shared. So thank you very much for your time today, Alison. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for having me.
You're more than welcome. Thank you also, everyone, for listening. I hope you found that helpful, inspiring, and continue to listen to the Customer Insight Leader podcast. More great interviews coming up, and each week there's fresh content on my blog, customerinsightleader.com. So you might want to check that out too. Before then, thanks everyone for your time. Have a great week. Enjoy being yourself, and bye for now.